Welcome to the World Architecture Festival podcast. This series features recordings from the annual festival, where architects and commentators discuss the latest challenges and innovations in the industry. Make sure you subscribe to always receive the latest episode, and also follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @WorldArchFest.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the Festival Hall stage and this session on housing, energy and construction, which we think is a very important and integral part of the theme of on housing that we are looking at over the course of this festival. And we've got two speakers, Celia Tilner, a partner, founder of Tilner & Villinger, firm of architects in Vienna. She is also a member of the advisory board for low-cost housing in Vienna, so she knows a great deal about this subject, how you get good housing that is energy efficient and also well-constructed. She's going to talk about two projects in Vienna. And then after her, we have James Pickard, founder of Cartwright Pickard, a firm in London, which has made a specialism of working creatively and constructively with different parts of the construction industry in order to achieve higher standards of construction, lower running costs, and consequent benefits for residents in, among other sorts of buildings, in low-cost housing. So I'd like to ask Celia to speak first, and both Celia and James to come up to the platform and commence the session.
Yes, hello, good day. I'm happy you're here to listen to my presentation. I will quickly start with showing you just one or two images of a project that our company was known for quite a while. Okay, yeah, that's very good. Thanks. Yeah, we started our company with urban design and urbanistic projects, and then we won a competition for Skyline Spittelau, and since the topic today is also construction, I just wanted to briefly mention this project because it won many awards and it's the project we are known for best. It's a construction on top of a historic viaduct by Otto Wagner, a former train line. And so we had to actually build, as you can see in this aerial image, on top of the former viaduct, build new construction connected to it, and also provide a pedestrian bridge linking the subway station on the left with the district on the right. So this was definitely one of the most complicated projects we ever worked on, and our structural engineer also said for him it was a huge challenge. And you can see in the sketch on the right, you know, how the project was really developed very site-specific for this particular location. And it's also a brownfield site. So this is a former storage site that would never have been used for a building site. And so I think it also explains the philosophy of our work in our office, that we quite often we define the projects ourselves. So in this case, I discovered the site, I looked for a developer, and I convinced the city that they should change the zoning from transportation to building. And I was successful with this, and then it was a competition, and we won the competition. So I think since, you know, the sites for building housing are becoming rare and not affordable anymore, we really have to start looking for different sites. And this is a mixed-use building. But this just shows you briefly the floor plan and how difficult it was to fit it into this particular site. But now I'm coming to the two projects that I want to show to you today in detail, because our firm has specialized in affordable housing projects, not luxury housing, affordable housing, and energy-efficient housing. And the city of Vienna has a brilliant program how to support affordable housing. The city itself owns still a lot of land, and it does not just give away the land, it sells it through competitions. And the competitions are such that a the housing, a nonprofit housing developer, teams up with an architect, and they provide a project that is not only architecturally designed, but also it has costs attached to it. And with costs, what they're interested in is the rent. It should be affordable rent. So the city of Vienna launched at Eurogate the first passive house settlement actually of the world with 800 apartments. It's being visited a lot from people from all over the world, China, Canada, because there's a huge interest in having an entire settlement out of passive houses. And you see two images of the southern facade of our project. But I quickly just want to explain, I mean, the passive house system, many of you probably know it, but it's really relying on having very being very well insulated, having a lot of insulation, high-performance windows, avoiding thermal bridges, but also controlled ventilation, meaning that the fresh air comes in controlled, and there's also extract air in a controlled manner. And so the airtight envelope is very important, but of course you can open the windows. A classic misunderstanding is that in a passive house you cannot open windows. Mainly you don't need any heating. There is no radiators for heating. We only do it for psychological reasons because people are not used to not having heating in their apartments. But the main issue is that with passive houses, they were done a lot for one-family homes, and they were always, in the appearance, very close. They had tiny openings and a lot of insulation. So the design goal for our project here, with which we won the competition, was to do something different, to create a passive house that doesn't look like a passive house with tiny windows, but that looks very open and very transparent and general. And the way we could do that is, you could see it in the sketches, the third one from the top, we created these southern balconies that are like a second layer in front of the building, and the actual facade is set back behind those balconies. And in a passive house, one of the biggest problems is overheating. So in summer, sometimes they actually really become too hot. And once they're too hot, they act like the old historic buildings. Once the heat is in, you don't get it out that easily. So a good method to prevent that is to have shading in the shading for the southern facades. This building is really oriented north-south, so the whole floor plan layout reacted to that with cross ventilation, which you see in the sketch from the second from the top, and also by putting all the access and circulation on the northern side and to use it as a buffer zone. Another thing that is also a philosophy of our firm, to design sustainable buildings in that sense that they're flexible. We always keep arguing for to our clients, the building should be possible to be changed, apartments should be changed, enlarged. You know, clients are usually hesitant to that, but we always succeed in getting it through. So I always like to visit buildings after they have been inhabited, and so you can see here some images that we had taken just recently with people living in it and using the balconies. And what is very interesting for us, that our client, you know, the housing developer, also lives there, and he reports that the community in the building is very, very well functioning. And they made an analysis with a questionnaire and talking to everybody. And what they found out is that these balconies that you can see, they're not on top of each other, but they're always diagonally, at a diagonal, which means that you can go out on your balcony and talk to your neighbor one floor below or one floor up. And it's actually happening, and they have a very good community in this building because of that. They're out on the balconies and communicating with each other. And the ground floor and the first floor is an intermediate zone with studios for working, and also some two-story apartments. And the upper floor is private apartment buildings that were sold. So it's really mixed in that sense. The upper floors were condominiums, but some of them affordable and some of them more expensive. And on the image on the left, you can see, of course, you know, towards the north, the passive house is more apparent, the northeast facade where you have the smaller openings. but these sort of cantilevering balconies create a typical image for this building. And then we have, of course, the terraces, and we also worked with wood. We like to reduce the structural, the concrete frames to the absolute minimum, and you can see on the image on the right, on the lower right, in the inside, you have then not the same thickness of the interior wall, but it's really changing. Where the wooden elements are, that's where the windows are, the wall is thinner. Of course, to use these wooden elements is more expensive, but we could convince the client to do that because you gain more square footage within the apartment, and it's more generous. And so that was sort of an offset. And of course, it's very nice for the atmosphere, and you can also see the wood on the outside. But it's used in a structural sense. And then the stairs, the access and circulation, the staircases are used as buffer zones. So in winter, the glass is closed, but it's not heated. And in summer, they can be opened, so it's good cross-ventilation there. And also prevents overheating. And also, again, the stairways are always designed in such a way that they're attractive, well lit, so people really like to walk on the stairs and not take the elevator. That's one of the goals. The second project that I'm going to show is Mount Namakov. The city of Vienna always has these competitions, these affordable housing competitions for larger sites. So it's not just one building, but it's like, let's say, 10 sites. And on each site, you have at least 5 to 10 architects with developers competing. And these competitions are really, really a lot of work because you cannot just hand in a design. You need all the calculations, you need the building physics, the structure, everything. So it's nearly like doing a schematic design. So if you lose, it's quite disappointing. In this case, we also won. And you can see, again, I mean, this strategy of wrapping the entire building with balconies. This is always a big discussion in affordable housing. I should mention this. These apartments rent for €7.50 a square meter. So you can have a 100 square meter apartment for €750. This is really, really affordable. And it's truly mixed use. And mixed in that sense of different incomes. So you can just see here the site plan and the layout of the two buildings. There's also this roof gardens. And the concept we presented in the competition was, the theme was intercultural living. So we said we will do a participation project with the residents, and we will work with them on their vision of how they want to live. And they can, this together with us, design all the communal spaces, also in the landscape, find out what the uses are that they would like, but also develop with them the apartments. And that was quite a challenge. This is just an image after the completion. And now I'll just run you briefly through the floor plans. This is the structural system. Again, it's reduced to a minimum, so we can really have a lot of flexibility for future changes. Then we wrap the building with continuous bands of balconies for the shading and larger projecting balconies. And all access and circulation and all the service areas are in the core of the building. So again, for the passive house, you need all these circulation of air, and that's all in that area that you can see in the blue. And the rest of the building is flexible. And here you see again the system of the passive house. We had, since we were working with the residents, we really had to explain this system to them because they need to understand that they are in a passive house and that the climate is quite different. It's a little cooler. It's, I think, more like in Great Britain in the buildings. Then again, as it was a competition for multicultural living, we proposed to have all the stairwells and the entire roof of the building and the ground floor for communal uses. And you see that in this section. The areas in white, they're all areas for communication, for meeting each other, and roof gardens with community gardening. And here in this section, you can see how this building works. So it has really these communal areas throughout the building. And our sociologist that worked with us is actually, she moved into the building so we can continuously study how it's working. And these floor plans are the ones we presented to the residents. We didn't allow them to do, you know, all changes, but we had the options, as you can see here, on the same location in the building, different types of apartments, smaller, larger, the kitchen open or the kitchen enclosed. So we ran them through these different options, and then they could pick in the same location, you know, if they wanted a larger one. It was like a Tetris game. So after everybody had decided which type of apartment they wanted, it sort of nicely fell into place. There was very, very high, you know, they're very satisfied with living there. And you can see again, of course, on the right side of the floor plan, all the ducts for the air, for the supply air and for the exhaust air. And that's in the stairwell, so that's quite practical because also for maintenance, the people can go to change the filters and go in the public spaces and don't have to go into the apartments. It's always, the floor plans are very important in these competitions. They really study, the jury studies them very carefully, and the sizes of the apartments are very strictly limited. Because, of course, they cannot be too large. And we have a trend now to build smaller and smaller apartments. And they're called smart apartments, but in reality, they're just 10% smaller than they used to be. And these are images just from this summer, again, so that you can see how the building is being inhabited. Of course, people are adding stuff to the balconies. They're adding visual protection. But we always try to incorporate that in that sense that it doesn't really disturb the appearance of the building. I mean, you can see how they're adding flower pots, and they're continuously, the participation is continuing. This summer they planted flowers together, so there's very good community spirit in this building. And if it wasn't that much work, I think I would like to do this in every project, because you don't get paid extra for doing this, so it's more like an ideological, idealistic thing. And you can see some images also of the garden terrace and beautiful view towards the city of Vienna. It's the 11th district, which is not too far from the airport. It's on that end of the city. And, you know, all these, a big discussion was always the balconies continuing along the facade, even in front of the bedrooms. And we always argue, well, it's good for the shading, but it's also, as you can see in these images, you can really put a lot of plants out there and have much more balcony space practically for free, because the apartments are getting smaller and smaller. So in this, I think my time is over. I will end right here. 1 minute, okay, then I just show you the latest housing project we just finished in Vienna. This is not affordable, this is luxury housing for Vienna standards. So those were condominium apartments, and the top one was sold for 3 million euros. And you can just see here sort of like a little, you know, a difference in standard, but it's not that much. I mean, we have really, with the affordable housing in Vienna, we also have a very, very high standard in the apartments. But of course, with the privately financed housing, you can have more generous spaces and work with more expensive materials. So we didn't have any plaster facades, but stone facades. So thank you. Yeah, the green one.
Okay, thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is James Pickard. I'm an architect based in London, but we have offices in London, Leeds, and Manchester. It would be inappropriate for a Brit to talk about passive house in the birthplace of passive house, and there's very little passive house in the UK. So I'm going to steer my talk primarily onto construction innovation and the way, as a practice, we try and innovate using the way we make buildings and exploit manufacturing techniques as far as possible to improve efficiency. So at Cartwright Pickard, we like to ask questions. We question the status quo. Why? Because questions lead to answers. Answers lead to ideas, and ideas lead to progress. We think that architects should be prophets. We strive to look 10, 15 years ahead with our designs so that our buildings are outperforming the competition. Architecture, particularly in London, is a very competitive marketplace, and we want our buildings to do what it says on the tin, plus a lot more. We also strive to achieve more with less, and we refuse to accept the way inefficient ways that buildings are built in the UK. I've got some quite interesting statistics that I'll come to on towards the end. But the construction industry, certainly in Britain, is very inefficient and innovates and changes very, very slowly. So we're constantly pushing the boundaries to try and do things better. As a practice, we're inspired by functionality, not style. Style is the last thing we're interested in. We want our buildings to work. Yes, we want them to be beautiful, but to paraphrase Mies van der Rohe, we believe we're creating architecture out of the means of construction. We're evidence-based designers, so unlike many architects, we carry out building performance evaluations of most of our completed buildings, so we find out what works, what doesn't work, and we use that information in a powerful feedback loop, if you like, to improve what we do and achieve continuous improvement. Most of the projects that I'll show you were won through a competition of some sort, and in all cases, the client was always really committed to the innovation that we applied. The projects were not tendered in a traditional sense. We persuaded our clients not to go out to half a dozen contractors and then be tempted by the lowest price. But we negotiated, we selected the right team, the right contractor, the right manufacturers to work with, and we told them what the price was. We said, this is the maximum price. We've got to pull this together and make it work within this agreed price. So the projects I'm going to show you were negotiated, not tendered, which is really fundamental to achieving innovation. At the backbone of the way we approach design is we design for manufacture, and we have a really we believe smart value chain. We call it not supply chain, but a value chain of very talented manufacturers that support what we do. So this is a project close to my heart. It's the first completed project that, as a practice, we built. We've been in business now for 19 years. This building was completed in November 1999. It was the first truly modular housing project in London, which used fully completed, fully fitted container form modules that were manufactured in a factory in the north of England, fully fitted out with bathrooms, kitchens, etc. What was quite radical about it was that we reduced the overall time on site compared to a traditionally scheme of 30 apartments from 12 months to 6 months. That the project was handed over with zero defects, which is the sort of holy grail in construction. Not a single item on the client's list of any defects, not one. What was quite nice was 5 years after occupation, Building Magazine revisited the building and interviewed the Peabody Trust, who were the client, to find out what the whole life costs were looking like. And the head of building maintenance at Peabody Trust stated that they were spending less than 20% of what they would have expected to on maintenance. And what it proved is that you get far higher construction quality when you use manufacturing techniques rather than building in a muddy, wet field, which is the way most buildings are built. We're also really proud that we strive to eradicate scaffolding and wet trades as far as possible. Not many people understand that scaffolding is one of the most dangerous activities on a building site, and in the UK, approximately two people are killed every fortnight on a building site, which is, in the same period of the Afghan War, more workers on British building sites were killed than British soldiers during the Afghan War, which is a pretty scary statistic. There's a plan there to just show you how we standardised the modules. There's two-bed, one-bed and three-bedroom apartments in here, and it's all let at 20% below market rent. It's sort of key worker housing, but with no government grant funding at all, built for just under £1,000 a square metre. To show how we learned and did it again, this was in the city of York, just outside the centre of York. We were asked to repeat the success of Murray Grove in the north of England. And 2 years later, this project was built for 15% lower construction cost in real terms. So we worked with the same manufacturer to keep improving and improving the whole process. We have a huge housing shortage, a housing crisis in the UK, and particularly London, where the UK is building approximately half of the homes it needs. And 17 years after we started this approach, it is now becoming mainstream. There are manufacturers in the UK that can go up to 25 stories with modular. And we've now really been inundated, particularly with a build-to-rent sector, by clients who are very frustrated with the increase in construction costs in the UK, which are sky high. Bourbon Lane was an international competition run by CABE. We did this jointly with the Paris-based practice BNC Architects, run by a very good friend of mine, Dino Casares, and we both did this competition together and won it. The client here is, again, like Peabody, one of the oldest housing charities in London called Octavia. The original competition brief asked for about 45 homes. Our competition-winning scheme actually got a 70% increase in the number of units, which we did through very clever use of the site and increasing density. So window to window between dwellings is 15 metres. We're in Hammersmith and Fulham. The London Borough of Hammersmith Fulham, they started off saying it had to be 20 metres. We demonstrated that we could reduce that, which allowed us to increase the density. The spaces between the buildings are really actively used, as this image shows. Cars are very controlled. But one of the key innovations we applied here, we used a steel frame, prefabricated steel frame, not a traditional concrete frame, which meant it went up very quickly. We designed out scaffolding by using a prefabricated light gauge steel cladding system. That saved £350,000 from the main contractor's budget. We persuaded the client to spend that £350,000 on a micro CHP plant, which has left a legacy for the residents of very reduced electricity costs and very reduced heating bills. Energy poverty is a big issue for residents of social housing. So this is a mixed tenure building, shared ownership and social rented. This is another international competition that we won, run by the World Steel Association, to come up with innovative uses for steel for affordable housing in emerging economies. So here we it's approximately, when you use a light gauge steel system, you can demonstrate that there's about half the embodied energy in this building. You can source light gauge steel that is 100% recycled, so you're not using diminishing resources on the planet. A couple of buildings here were built as demonstration buildings at the University of Real Estate in Chongqing, and we built a few buildings in the earthquake zone of Chengdu, where there was a huge earthquake about 10 years ago in the Sichuan province that killed about 100,000 people. This then led to a commission from the World Steel Association to design what's called a Novo House product, which is an earthquake-resistant housing system which will cope with a force 7 earthquake and a force 4 hurricane. And they've used the product in places like Haiti for housing paid for by the Red Cross. Incredibly fast, uses half the embodied energy of traditional concrete forms of construction. This is a project in London. You can see the yellow dots, the O2, that's the River Thames, the red dots, the site at the mouth of the River Lee. we originally received a commission from the landowner and Peabody Trust to design an inhabited bridge over the mouth of the River Lea, which we did 15 years ago. The Transport for London, controlled by the Greater London Authority at the time, was enthusiastic but changed their mind. Apparently they've changed their mind back 15 years later, so the landowner has been back in touch, and we're now potentially, hopefully, going to see this. Who knows? But anyway, it's incorporating 100 affordable homes, which will probably be built to rent, into a steel structure that's spanning over the mouth of the River Lea. We're looking to get the money from TfL would go into the steel structure for the bridge they require, which will pay for the structure that we're using here, which will be totally prefabricated. All of the homes are modularized, and the entire structure has been designed so it can be brought up on large floating vessels and barges with cranes on that will erect it from the river itself. So we're hopeful it'll move forward. We're dusting it all off, and it's just quite an exciting use of off-site manufacturing. We have done a passive house. When we built this, it was the largest passive house development in London. When we started working on it, there were only about 5 passive houses in the whole of the UK. The real challenge for us was in most of the passive houses we went to see in Germany and Scandinavia were rendered or clad in timber, which is quite an easy way of covering up the really thick insulation you need to achieve the U-values. But when you work in a conservation area in London, you've got to hang brickwork off the facade, and you've got to keep the wall thicknesses down to about maximum 400 millimetres. So it was incredibly challenging to do that. Probably about 15% more expensive than more traditional forms of construction. So why are we striving to innovate and drive down costs? This slide just shows you, I believe New York is now cheaper than London. I've been reliably told by a number of developers. But London is, I understand, the most expensive place on the planet. And as you can see, the UK occupies most of those slots. The UK is the most expensive country in the world to build anything. So we can't afford to sit around and do nothing. We have to innovate. We have a huge skill shortage. The industry is essentially dysfunctional. And the large construction companies make almost no profit. So when you make no profit, there's no innovation, no research and development, and we get this stagnation. This is a fairly depressing statistic for the UK economy. One of the reasons we believe this is the case in the UK is the lack of use of off-site manufacturing. This is a really interesting slide. I keep showing this to the UK government when I'm asked to talk to them about the housing issues. The UK builds a tiny amount of self-build and custom-build housing compared to most of Europe, which is well above 50%. If we only allowed self-build to occur in the UK in the way it does elsewhere in Europe, I think we'd solve our housing crisis very quickly. We have about 7 or 8 volume house builders, we call it, really the big companies, who land bank huge amounts of land intentionally to drip feed the market and stop competition. So there's a real undersupply of housing in the UK, which is why we have house price inflation, I'm sure you've read about, which is sort of 15 to 20% a year sometimes, and London is now the most expensive place on the planet to live. Young people simply cannot afford to live in London. So a one-bedroom studio apartment in Camden starts at around £500,000, £600,000, £700,000 for a sort of the bottom end of that market. A two-bedroom flat in Camden could be 1.1, 1.2 million for a flat. There are flats being sold in London for 25 million. You know, it's a crazy situation. So we've got to innovate. We're still using technology in Britain that was invented 6,000 years ago. Most homes in Britain are built using load-bearing brick. Something's got to change if we carry on like this. So what is the future? It's got to be about smart buildings. I quite like this slide. I mean, the Brit that designed the iPad and the iPhone for Apple, who then set up Nest, which is basically, it's got a smoke detector and a thermostat that learns, and sold that business for $3.2 billion to Google. The chap to the left there, Demis, is I see him every day when I drop my kid off at school in the mornings. His son is in the same class as my son. He developed artificial intelligence that beat the European champion at that game, Go, these little black and white discs. And he set his firm up in 2012, and he's just sold it for $650 million to Google, which sort of indicates where the future lies. Artificial intelligence and what that can do to sensor technology and the way we build buildings. So, there are some interesting things happening in the UK, but we need to join up the dots. And this certainly, my view, is the future. BIM is a really big thing in the UK, perhaps more than many other European countries. We are about to embark on a 7D BIM project, which takes BIM to the ultimate holy grail, I suppose, which is where the smart, intelligent model that we hand our client will predict all of the running costs of that building through its 100-year life, in all the maintenance, every single nut and screw and fan will be fully detailed in the model, and it will actively report to the client when things need to be changed, filters need to be changed, etc., which will allow developers, particularly in the build-to-rent market, to predict what their running costs are, and that's a really important part of the viability for build-to-rent, which is a new sector in the UK. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, I'm afraid we're more or less out of time for discussion, but there are just a few concluding remarks and points that I would like to make. One is, I think the issue of energy costs and energy poverty that you both mentioned, that particularly in affordable housing, if you can drive down energy consumption and the cost of energy, the benefits you can bring, the social benefits you can bring to the residents are quite significant. And I imagine that's as true in Vienna as it is in the UK. Is that...
Well, the energy costs, make a large portion of, the monthly costs that each resident has. So in the passive house, for example, they have practically no costs. It's like the heating is not necessary. It's more like maintenance cost in general. Yeah. So I think that's a big topic in affordable housing. Of course, it's more expensive to build it in the first place. And a big discussion, I don't know if it's in UK, but in Austria, a big discussion is, of course, happening now regarding the technology involved. It is a more complicated technology. It needs to be well maintained. A lot of residents are overwhelmed with, changing a filter or something. So there needs to be a training. That's why we found the participation project worked really well, because you got to know the residents and you could explain them the technology. So I think those are the issues. But, of course, it's much more affordable and it's energy saving.
Good. James, just last comment to you, really to ask you to make a single prediction, if you can, for how the sort of innovation in digital technology that's going on in London could impact the construction industry, particularly the construction process.
I think that I alluded to it with a reference to BIM at the end. I think that the way that CAD is now going, the architect's designs will be more and more tuned to design for manufacture, and will streamline the whole process of construction and allow manufacturers and manufacturing processes to be more coordinated, I guess, with the design. So I think the UK is probably in many ways behind other countries in Europe in this, particularly in housing. As I mentioned, that the self-build market is tiny in Britain compared to most of Europe, and actually the self-build, people who are building a house for themselves, they want the quality. They'll pay for triple glazing, they'll pay for a heated floor, they'll pay for things that you don't get when you buy a speculatively built house by one of the house builders in the UK. And what that has done is, in countries like Germany and Sweden and France, is you have quite innovative, modest-sized manufacturing companies that make timber frame, flat pack systems, precast concrete, steel, and there's a really successful supply chain of small manufacturers making highly engineered, very, very high performance homes of high quality. We just don't have it in the UK yet, but one day maybe it'll come.
I was impressed that Austria was number one on that list. You know, yeah. It's like for the self-built component. I think that's actually, we have a very high frequency of these markets where you can buy all the stuff to build your own home. So.
Good. Well, we could obviously go on talking about this, and but we're coming to the end of this session. We will start again here at 2:20 with Ole Schieren, who won the Building of the Year prize with the housing scheme in Singapore. And on the Festival Hall stage, James will be talking again about issues of health in buildings, and the impact, the social impact of health in buildings, about which you have conducted research for various governments, I believe.
Yeah, so please come. I don't know what time it is, but this afternoon I'm talking
2:20, about... 2:20, Festival Hall stage.
Wellness.
Thank you very much. See you later.